because of my really very advanced level, I learned a good deal at home from my brothers, mm-hmm. and in informal education in Germany. I was a member of a youth movement. So, let me put it this way, I had more knowledge about Jewish problems and Jewish history, and Jewish affairs around the world, and just about anybody I knew.
Well, that made it a little difficult to relate, I imagine.
So, yes, and I was very much involved with what was going on, reading the newspapers, and I assure you at White Plains, New York, there weren't many of my contemporaries who read the New York Times every day.
Yes, I would believe that. Well, now, we come to your college and professional education, and I believe you went to Cornell? What fills in the gap there between high school?
Well, I first applied. I didn't have money to go to college, of course, so I applied to, got into the College of the City of New York, CNY, and decided to study engineering or something.
That was tuition free, was it?
It was tuition free, mm-hmm. yes. And there, after 1 year, I decided I was admitted to Cornell University, and I wanted to go out of town, partly to be independent, to live on my own. And I was able to get a scholarship. And so I went to Cornell, and there majored in rural sociology.
I see. What years were those?
1937.
For 4 years?
For 3 years. I got 1 year credit for CC.
Oh, for CC, I see.
But one condition was, they didn't like too many of these New York Jews to go to Cornell University. It was quite still, anti-Semitism was a factor. But because I had good credentials, they admitted me under condition that I would get some farm experience, because you couldn't graduate unless you had 2 summer internships in agriculture.
And your major was what, did you say?
Rural sociology.
Rural sociology.
So in order to stay in school and graduate, I had to acquire agricultural experience, which I didn't have. So the first summer, they found me a job as a worker to a farmer who turned out to be an Armenian, whose family had gone through the Armenian Holocaust, and in the living room they had a huge picture of the atrocities committed against the Armenians. He was a man who worked very hard and
worked you very hard?
Worked extremely hard. And I had never done any farm work, any physical labor, so getting up at 5 o'clock every morning to milk the cows. And the cows are very temperamental, so it took me a while for them to get psychologically used to me and to accept the manner in which I milked. These were not milking machine days. It was milk by hand. So I worked from 5:30 in the morning till late, until it got dark. The farmer fed me. I think I got $30 a month, enough to get into town once in a while. But it was very confining.
Where was this?
It was in New York State near Cornell University. But I had to stick it out whether I liked it or not. The farmer just was... you know, the food was acceptable, the conditions were difficult, but the only time I had to myself was part of Sunday. I would go into town to, for example, I would go to church in the morning sometimes to get acquainted with rural people.
Mm-hmm.
And one time I finally decided to get a friend of mine to send me a telegram that... my grandmother was very ill, so I could get a weekend off.
That was
the only way I could do it.
How long did you stay there?
That was 10 weeks.
I see.
Yeah. So, but I met the academic requirement. I learned a lot.
That was your sophomore year at Cornell?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next year, this Because I was able to get a research job in a rural area in Spencer, New York, to work with a team of researchers at Cornell who were investigating what happens to a New York village when it gets invaded by foreigners. In New York State, there are, of course, many farmers that have been there for generations. And as they get older, their children don't want to farm. And in this particular village, there had been some Finnish immigrants, and gradually the Americans had to sell their farms as they got older to the Finns. So when I was there, half the village was Finnish, and half was American. And we were studying what's happening to the class and caste system.
The two cultures.
The Americans were the politically powerful people. They had the wealth. They were important. The Finns were working hard. They were taking over. They were making more money. And so we were studying these two communities. And we interviewed people in English and in Finnish. I didn't speak Finnish, but we had the questionnaire translated into Finnish. So that was a very interesting experience.
Well, that was your junior year. Then.
That was my junior year.
I see.
So I learned a great deal about the United States in these 2 weeks.
What directed you to rural sociology as a major?
Well, I was considering going to Israel after I graduated. It was a rather naive choice because this was not a subject that was really very relevant to Israel, but I didn't know that. Rural sociology was too researchy. But I felt social sciences, if you apply them, could make a big difference. And I realized today that in order to apply the social sciences, the opportunities in other fields like economics are much greater.
So you were very idealistic.
Yes. So I graduated from Cornell in 1940. At the age of 20.
I see. And you financed yourself with scholarships? Is that the idea?
Mm-hmm.
I see.
And work. I mean, I worked really...
Well, these were really depression years.
Oh, yes. I mean, I waited on tables. And,
What communication did you have with your parents?
Oh, letters for weekly.
Uh-huh. And when did you learn of their fate?
Well, not really until World War II.
I guess the letters stopped after a while.
Yes, from relatives. No, the letters didn't stop. They were able to mail letters. After all, we didn't get into the war till 1941.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they were both in the process of trying to get out. And I had relatives in Sweden through whom they corresponded, and they tried to help them to get out. So I knew of deportation in 1943. Happened in 1942, I believe.
Okay.
But I didn't know what their fate was until 1945, when, as a soldier in the U.S. Army, I was able to go to Holland as soon as it was liberated. And then I was sent by the U.S. Army to Theresienstadt, the concentration camp, to which they might have been sent to get the names of the people who were liberated after the Russians liberated. I somehow convinced my commanding officer that we should go there and get information about who survived to arrange for transportation of the survivors into Allied areas, and he thought that was a good idea, so he made arrangements for me to go with a driver and a car to Theresienstadt as soon as we heard that it was liberated by the Russians. So I was one of either the first or second American who got there.
Mm-hmm.
And there I learned that they had not gone to Theresienstadt, because they had complete lists of who survived and who had been there. And and that arrangements were made to bring the people who survived back to the West. Mm-hmm. Well, that probably speeded the process too, the Russians.
How did you find out about your parents then, Dr. Eaton?
Well, I didn't know exactly for sure until, I knew when I went to Holland again in 1945. I was able to go to Amsterdam where they lived. And I learned about the deportation of all people. And my mother had been hiding in a village, so she evaded being taken for some months until some local Dutchman denounced her. And I got the name of the Dutchman. You know, he survived. The Dutch didn't do very much. He was a quisling, as they called
him. That's a term from the past, really.
Yeah, this is not. It's not. It was not serious enough for the Dutch government. There just were so many people. I mean, we know the Dutch as being people who helped the Jews, which they did, but they were also quite a few Dutch Nazis. I learned about these Dutch Nazis as a result. So yes, I knew that they were killed and that they were deported, and that in Holland, you found out that there were just practically no survivors. So I had no reason. But it took about a year before the Red Cross, apparently, with records that the Germans kept meticulously, could give me information that they died at Birkenau, which is near Auschwitz.
But they were not together, they were separated?
They were separated, yes. Went on separate transports. Because, as I said, my mother was hiding.
Yes.
And they had been divorced. And,
yes, that's what I mean. But where did you then follow your education after Cornell? You took a master's?
Well, I decided then that I wanted to learn something about applied social sciences. And so I enrolled in the School of Social Work at the University of Chicago.
I see.
Where I got a scholarship and a job. And shortly after I got there, I was called by a person who was interested in selling the idea to the U.S. Department of Agriculture of establishing kibbutzim in the United States.
I see.
Edward Norman was his name. Edward Norman was the son of a very wealthy American Jew who had been to Palestine and who established the Jewish Cultural Foundation. One of his hobbies was that he felt that the kibbutz was a great idea. And he sold the Secretary of Agriculture, Henry Wallace.
Oh, yes.
On this, who had also been in Palestine and got excited about Jewish settlements there. So he decided to make a study, after discussing it with Wallace, of America's experience with collective farming. And he got my name from someplace by virtue of the fact that while I was in college, a term paper of mine was published in a scholarly journal.
This was
in Cornell.
In Cornell, yes.
So I had a paper, my first publication was a study of the agricultural settlements in Israel. And so I was a natural person when he found out who I was. He asked me to come to New York. Would I be willing to make this study? Well, I just started my graduate school, so I agreed to spend 6 months to look into its feasibility, because he didn't know and I didn't know if there was anything to study here other than historical experiences like, for example, the Oneida farms, where Oneida silver was made. Well, this is a collective farm, historically, of Protestants who got together and who believed that living together and sharing things in common was important. They also believed in, they had in wife ex- chain in sexual open marriages. Mm-hmm. So this was a very scandalous group. And there were out here in near Pittsburgh, we have the Rappists, a farm that was collected. But I didn't really know, neither did he, if there was anything. So we agreed that I would work and try to collect material if there's something worth studying. So
well, did you take a leave of absence?
No, no. I just dropped my job. I was going to work in a home for the aged.
No, I mean, were you already at the University of Chicago?
Yeah, I was at Chicago. So instead of working in a home for the aged,
I
did library research and did some traveling and went down to Washington and met key officials of the Department of Agriculture and then came up with a proposal to make a study. And after...
Harmony?
Harmony, yes. And so after two quarters at Chicago, I moved to New York to set up an organization called the Rural Settlement Institute and organized the study, which meant doing field work all over the United States, visiting places where such...
How old were you at this point?
21.
I see.
And among them were the Hutterites, which is a religious community of Anabaptists who had come to this country in 1874 to 77, and who actually operate such communities. I had to learn how to drive because I never drove before in a car, and did field work. And just in the middle of that study, World War II had broken out, of course, in 1941. But because I was an enemy alien, I was not allowed to volunteer.
What about citizenship?
I was an enemy alien. I was a German citizen.
When did you become a citizen?
After I got in the army.
I see.
So they wouldn't take me. So I continued the research.
I see.
And protested my status, as did most other German Jews who were in the same situation. They weren't anxious to make people citizens in those days. And finally, the rules were changed in 1942, and that German Jews were not considered Germans. It took the U.S. government a long time to make that decision. And then I was suddenly drafted.
You didn't get to finish the master's then?
No. Uh-huh. And nor did I finish my field work. But I'd done enough work so that even after I was drafted, I finished the manuscript and was able to find a publisher for it. So I was enrolled at that time at Columbia University, taking an evening course in the PhD program.
You were able to enter the PhD program without having completed
the master's? Right, right. Yeah, at Columbia, you can.
I see.
So it turned out that my book was published, and I asked them to accept it as a doctoral thesis. Because at Columbia at that time, in order to get your doctorate, you had to get your thesis published, which is an expensive matter if you publish your own. And I had a publisher for my book before I really had taken more than 5 courses towards the doctorate. I mean, they're really master's level courses. But because of the war for patriotic purposes and so on, the faculty decided to accept it as a doctoral thesis, provided I met all the other requirements. So when I came back after the war, I was the only student who had finished his thesis before finishing any of my courses.
What? You say it was published under what title?
Exploring Tomorrow's Agriculture.
I see.
And,
but there was no practical application made of that idea.
Well, it was so practical that the U.S. government adopted an experimental program to set up collective farms in this country, 27 of them, the Farm Security did. And I visited each one of them, well, with 2 exceptions. And they were beginning to operate at that time, about 2 or 3 years at the most, some only 1 year. And then during World War II in 1941 already, and certainly by 42, there was increasing opposition to these experiments in the South, where many of them were located, because these communities that had been set up by the Department of Agriculture had taken farm laborers who were very poor and who were working for a dollar a day and given them opportunities to become members of such a farm where they got a house, and there was a farm manager who helped them learn how to operate a large farm, and they were beginning to do well, and as a result were making money and living at a higher standard of living than their cousins and brothers and so on in the community who had to work as farm laborers for a dollar a day. And this resulted in pressure in these local areas where these communities were for higher wages, plus the war. And the local larger farmers didn't like having so many uppity farm laborers. And they were putting pressure on the congressmen to do something to get rid of these bad examples. After all, these were like communist villages, collective farms. So actually a bill was introduced in Congress to require the Department of Agriculture to stop all subsidies and to withdraw all agricultural services and employers from these communities. And it passed in the House. And when it came up before the Senate, I heard about it, and I decided, like, heck, I'm doing research on this, and this makes no sense. So I got myself invited to testify in the Senate, and I testified against this clause in the Agricultural Expropriation Bill. And, you know, very famous senators that remained in the Senate for years. And I apparently converted them completely, and they struck out this clause, so it did not get into the final bill. But the next year, when I was in the Army in 43, it was written into the bill again, and this time it passed. So yes, by the time I came back from the war, all of these communities had been dissolved, except one. And I visited that community to find out why didn't they get dissolved. The people refused to accept government requests and inducements. The government paid these people to break up. Of course, there's a lot of money to do that. But politically, that was, you know, the conservative Southerners were very influential in the New Deal, remember? So. But this one community, which was made up of Indians, if the government wanted something, they knew it was not good for them.
So they were so right.
So they just resisted, seeing if they wanted so badly after they organized our collective farm, we can't trust them, so they refused.
Did it exist for a while then?
Yes, they made more money by staying together longer, and then later on they sold their land at much higher prices and so on.
Does it still exist?
No.
Did you complete your PhD at Columbia before the war? Did you
go
back?
No, I had hardly any courses other than my thesis.
I see. And where were you in service?
I was in service in Europe. Mm-hmm. I first was sent to a program set up to prepare people to govern France. Not that I spoke French, I didn't, but I had other qualifications, so I was sent to Queen's College to learn how to speak French and all about French government and French judiciary, industry, economy, and everything else. And then one day at Casablanca, President Roosevelt was talking by Churchill to agree that the French resistance leaders, de Gaulle, should be allowed to govern France. Roosevelt had been very much against it. He didn't trust de Gaulle. He felt he didn't represent France. So our policy was to take over France, to provide military government until there could be free election, and not let the free French impose their particular approach. That was the U.S. policy. But then when that political decision was made, suddenly there were about 10,000 people who had been were being prepared to be in French military government, who became surplus. And so most of them, because they had high IQs, were sent to the infantry. But they were all interviewed, and I was interviewed by intelligence agency. And the thing that they were interested in is, would I be willing to volunteer for a assignment where the chances of coming back alive were no more than 50%, maybe less. Well, how could I say no? So I said yes. And so I found myself transferred to the psychological warfare branch of the U.S. Army, which the mission of which was to prepare radio broadcasts and leaflets to get the Germans to surrender. And so
this was still based in France?
That was still based in the United States.
Oh, I see.
And no, we never got to France.
Oh, I see.
But we didn't get into France until 1944, anyhow. That was in 1943. So I was transferred to the psychological warfare branch and sent to Maryland in what now is the President's Retreat at Camp
David,
yes. That was called Camp Ritchie. And learned how to do radio broadcasting and newspaper writing. And the main reason they selected me is because I spoke German. But I was one of the very few German refugees who spoke English well, could write English, and mm-hmm. published a book. So they needed people who could translate leaflets that were written in German mm-hmm. into English. Actually, I found that my German wasn't as good as it needed to be to, let's say, write a leaflet without having somebody check it, because I didn't speak any German since I arrived in this country.
Since you were 14?
I had no one to speak German with. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even interested in it mm-hmm. very soon afterwards. So, I was in the psychological warfare branch. Might have been later on, was considered for a mission that would have dropped me in behind the lines. But I guess they finally decided to abandon that. And I spent my war years really in a very interesting service. A small group of people who ran Radio Luxembourg, and then I became editor of a newspaper for the occupied population of Bavaria, and ran that newspaper, interviewed people and did stories. And this gave me a great deal of freedom to travel, because I had my own jeep, and as editor of the newspaper I could pretty much decide where I would go to write stories in my district.
This was where were you based again?
Well, first we were sent to England to be trained together with the British in advanced techniques of psychological warfare. And then there was a selection process for the Office of Strategic Services, as I said, to be dropped behind the lines. But then that idea was dropped, so I stayed in psychological warfare and landed in France few weeks after Normandy mm-hmm. to go to the front and interview German prisoners, and was stationed in Radio Luxembourg, which had been freed, and the main Allied radio station was there, that was the center, so we would go to the front, interview people, and then go back, prepare leaflets. Stories. And it was a rather small group of people who ran the service, but it was a very influential one, and we worked directly from Eisenhower's headquarters. So I was
going to say, who headed this division?
Well, the person who headed the newspaper radio division was a man named Hans Haber. Mm-hmm. He was a refugee himself who had volunteered to fight in the French army when the war broke out. He was an Austrian. He was a Hungarian. His father was a Jew. His mother was a Jew, but he wanted to make it in the system, so he became a Catholic. And then, if people ask him what his former religion was, he changed that to Protestantism, so he could say it.
I see.
He was the editor of a scandalous journal that basically dealt in blackmail. I don't think they have anything quite like this in the United States because they would have too many court lawsuits. But it was one of these sensational things, newspapers, like the Enquirer and so on. And Hans Harvey was quite ashamed of his father, especially since his father in World War I shot himself in the foot so he wouldn't serve in the Austrian army. And it was a fairly dishonest man, but young Hans was very unhappy. He became a reporter. And when World War II broke out in 1939,